Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Bill Murray. I'll be your host this evening. I'm coming to you live from beautiful Southeast Florida tonight, and I am myself an adult survivor of child abuse. Tonight we have a really special show because it's one of our older members, one of our longer members, Lorianne Smith from Alberta, Calgary, Canada. She's a longtime NASCA family member, and she serves as Alberta's ambassador to NASCA. You may or may not know this, but Lori and I discussed it before the show. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Now, we don't cover issues of domestic violence from the perspective of the adults that are involved in domestic violence, but we do cover domestic violence as it relates to the children who grew up in those kinds of homes, because it's our belief that what we call secondhand domestic violence it indicates how hard it is on children raised in homes with domestic abuse and family violence. So Lori, who understands this problem tonight, is going to review the adult problems that she's had because of this trauma. And in the course of the telling of her life story, she'll tell what it was like to grow up in that situation, and as they say, how it affected her in adulthood, and then what she's done about it. Her challenges are the result of years of abuse, neglect, and toxic family behaviors that she experienced as a child, and that's a perfect topic for October. So we're going to ask her to discuss her healing journey, especially as it's related to what she's done to gain some adult survivor coping skills. And I know this is going to be a fantastic show. People are starting to call in, and I appreciate that. I had to reboot my computer, and it did an update on me when I did so. Now I'm just getting back to the regular screen, and I should be able to enter names in a second. But right now, I don't have the ability to enter the names that are usually entered here. I do have three participants already. I know one of them's Lori. Lori, why don't you enter your name so I can see which one you are? And I'm almost ready to start entering names myself. But I don't want to open the wrong mic at the wrong time. Tonight's show will be 90 minutes long. We're going to have plenty of time to discuss all the things that I explained Lori's going to cover. And a couple of the guests that we have, I know, will be interested in not only in the topic Lori's going to talk about, but also her life story, her personal life story, because, as I say, we know Lori very well at NASCA. She's been a member for a long time. And she is the Alberta ambassador. A lot of people know Lori, in other words. They may or may not know her story very well, and it is some story. So without further ado, let me try opening this number here. I believe this is going to be Lori, and see what we get. Lori, is that you?
Hello, hello. It's me.
Hi.
Hi, Bill. I'm trying to get into the site.
Okay, I just now opened the Excel page, so I can see the numbers. So I'm that close to being in the normal mode.
Oh.
But in any case, I do want to thank you for being here. I don't want to put too much weight on you tonight. It is, you know, something that you and I talked about going back some time, that we would dedicate tonight to some degree, at least, to the issues that a child who experiences domestic violence, not only what they experience during their childhood, which you're going to cover first, but also how it affects their adulthood and how it affects their, you know, their coping skills and their healing journey eventually. You've done all of that work. So I'm really, really glad to have you here. And we have a couple other people. I know one of them is Darlene. And let me say hello to them as we go along here. And the other, I'm not sure yet, but I'll find out in just a moment. All right, but let's go with the Darlene first. Darlene, thank you for joining us tonight for Lori's. Hi, how are you?
I'm fair to middling, I suppose. How are you tonight?
All right. Well, we're all right. We're hanging in there. The other caller here is William, your cohort there.
Yeah,
I don't know who's
cohort.
In Alabama. Yeah, I don't know who's in Alabama and who's in Tennessee. It doesn't really matter to us, but you could be in either place, so that's what I'm saying.
I'm back home.
I think
he just got back home from Tennessee last night.
All right, so we got William, and these two southern accents here are going to be William and Darlene, and William's going to be the male voice, all right? So let's open his voice, his mic, and welcome him too. William, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. You know, one of our favorite members, a longstanding member, who is now actually helping us with the hosting chores. She'll start doing that next week. Lori Ann Smith from Alberta, Canada, is the guest tonight. And as I explained as we opened up the show, she has a specific task that we're going to make sure gets included. Lori, whenever you're ready, why don't we start with, you know, as I said, the kind of home you grew up in, and then we'll move forward from there. So this is Lori Ann Smith from Alberta, Canada. We are delighted to have you, of course. Lori?
Yeah, hi, everybody. Hello, everybody. Hello, everyone streaming in, and Darlene and William, thanks for joining us. And I'm glad to be here tonight. I've been around for a long time doing stuff on Blog Talk Radio and with NASCA and different groups, and I just wanted to be a person to try to help and make a difference in this mess, you know, for children, because I grew up in it, so I understand it. And I thought, you know, I could just sit on the sidelines and be quiet, or I could try to help make a difference in this, and that's what I've been doing, trying anyway. I grew up in a home full of domestic violence and abuse, family violence, and dysfunction. My story, you know, I wrote books and stuff on it, but so I won't go into too many, you know, all the details. I'll just sort of keep it tonight regarding about the domestic violence and abuse and stuff. But my parents were born, they were born and raised in Canada, in Nova Scotia. Both of them were abused as children. My mom was physically abused and, psychologically, mentally, verbally abused by her mother. My dad was abused by his mother psychologically. I don't know of any other type, but I know for sure psychologically. That's about all I know about that. But they both had a lot of problems before they were married. And they got married. My mom married my dad to get away from her abusive mother. So, you know, I think she loved him, obviously, but I don't know if she would have jumped to marry him, because he was already abusing her a bit before they were married. But she was just wanting to get away from her tyrant mother, my grandmother. And so she married my dad, and they started out on this horrific journey. It just never stopped until the day my mom died. And they were married for a long time. They stayed together. They didn't separate, no divorce. They had a very volatile relationship. My mom would tell me things about my dad, because I'm the last of seven children. I'm the seventh born baby, this youngest in the family. And I was kind of a captive audience for my mom. She would tell me all sorts of things about my dad and gripe about him and talk about how badly he had mistreated her and my older siblings when they were kids. And, you know, she was always sort of mentioning things like that. So I sort of held on to that in my mind, you know, that this had been a problem for them way before I had come along. I was born late. I was born out of marital rape. My mom was told not to have any children after my brother, the fifth child was born, but she ended up having two more stillborn babies, and because she wasn't supposed to have any more children, she was too sick and too broken down from the violence and from the fighting and from having so many children. And the doctors were like, you know, you're going to die if you keep having children. You just have to stop. But my dad wouldn't allow her to get on birth control. This was back in the 60s when I came along. I was born in 65. And my sister and I made it, but two didn't. So my mom had four more pregnancies, full term, after my brother, the fifth child. So there would have been nine of us, but seven of us made it. And we barely made it, let me tell you. It was pretty rough going. But she really didn't want any of these children. You know, she had all these children. She didn't really want them. They were abusing my siblings long before I was born. So my mom had taken my dad to court to divorce him in Canada in the 40s, and they wouldn't allow it because they said there was no infidelity. My dad wasn't sleeping around on her or whatever. So they didn't care about the abuse. This was back in the 40s in Canada. They were like, you know, you have to stay with them. Too bad. So they wouldn't let them divorce. So my mom kind of just gave up. You know, she really just felt trapped in this whole thing. And she had her own set of problems. My parents were busted on child abuse charges in the 60s, when I was born, right around the time I was born. And we had social workers coming around for a few years, and then they signed off the case. But they were diagnosed at the time when they were busted and had to go to court for child abuse charges. They had psych tests done on them, psychiatric tests. And my dad was diagnosed schizophrenic and borderline personality disorder. And he definitely was schizophrenic. He had problems, you know, he really did. He was, his mother and my grandmother and my grandfather were related too closely. They were cousins, and I think that's what caused that. But anyway, lots of brain problems. My dad's side of the family had lots of tumors, like brain tumors and all kinds of problems. And I kind of think it was because of that. And they were not only that, they were cousins, way too closely related, like first cousins. That was back in the late 1800s when they got married. My parents were born in the 20s, and their parents were born in the late 1800s. So that just tells you, going way back. right around the turn of 1900s. So we're talking old stuff, right? And these would be my grandparents, right? So I never met them. They were long past before I was born even. And but I just used to hear stories about them. But my dad had always had this issue that my mom was unfaithful to him. Because she was told not to have any more children and would try to sort of stop him, you know what I mean, from his desire to, you know, to keep going sexually or whatever. You know, he took it that, you know, she just didn't love him and that, you know, why wouldn't she want to die for him, right? My mom just didn't want to die. They told her, you get pregnant again, you're going to die. That's all there is to it. And so he didn't care. And that was just obvious. My parents did not, actually neither one of them cared about each other, but or their children. But it was just evident, you know, it was so in everybody's face that he just did not care about her. He just wanted his needs met. And that's basically the way that it went. You know, he continued to try to force himself on her for years and years. So my parents, after the social workers had signed off the case, the abuse started back up big time. My parents were abusing all of us, any of the siblings that were in the house. Two of my siblings had moved out by the time I was born, the oldest ones. And one left, went on the streets. He was like, I'm gone. And the other one got married at a young age and got out of the house. But, they, you know, she would, my sister who moved out of the house, the oldest, she wouldn't talk about it all the time, but she had mentioned a few things that had gone on, you know, when she was there. And my parents had abused her too. They abused all of us. And it's a sad cycle of abuse. They were abused. They abused us. But to grow up in a house like that with domestic violence, my dad was often threatening to kill my mother. And he was threatening to kill the family, like in a familicide thing. He was psychologically sick, like very, very unwell. And in the middle of the night, he would walk around talking about how he should kill us all and kill himself because we were all from the devil. We all deserve to die and this sort of thing. I remember being little and being very much afraid of, obviously afraid of my parents because they were abusing me, but also just the fear, you know, that they could kill me, that my dad, you know, might lose it and kill me at some point or kill my mom. I used to go to school and sit in class and just have a lot of fear. I think children that grow up in homes with domestic violence, there's a lot of fear involved. And the question of why does mommy and dad fight? You know, why are they so angry at each other? Why does my dad hit my mother and my mom throw things at my dad? You know, this sort of stuff, it's hard for children. They don't understand at all what's going on. Sometimes children blame themselves. I didn't blame myself because I had all these older siblings that, you know, I figured it wasn't necessarily my fault that all this was going on. I was the last born. I didn't take that on. But I just couldn't understand, you know, why they were the way that they were. It was normal for me because I grew up in it. But it's very uncomfortable, you know. My dad tried to drive me and my sister over a cliff one time when I was just little. I don't even remember this, but my sister told me about it, and then my mom told me about it. He was going to kill me and my sister with him, just driving us over a cliff in the mountains one time. And my sister screamed, and he stopped the vehicle before it went over. Obviously, I wouldn't be here. but this is the kind of stuff that he would do. And so I was very leery of my dad, very much afraid of him. When I was really little, especially when I was really little. And my mom, I just feared beatings from her because that's basically what the issue was with my mom. She was so tired and so run down and worn out by the time I came around. She was like, you know, just stay away from me. Your best just to stay away from me because I'll hurt you. And she did. But the issue is my brothers would try to keep my dad away from her. My dad continually tried to rape her and did rape her. He raped her in front of me one time when I was 6 years old. He didn't realize I was in the room, but I was sleeping on a couch that was in the room. We were poor, so we had a lot of people in a small house. So there was couches for people. You know, I was sleeping on the couch one night. And he didn't realize I was there, and he raped my mother in front of me. So it was still going on, you know. It was absolutely horrific. I knew... you know, there was severe problems in the home. And my older siblings, my brothers, would try to stop him. Somebody would have to stay awake at night to try to keep him away from her. And it was really a nightmare for them, I'm sure. They were all using drugs at this time and, you know, started experimenting with drugs at a very young age, my brothers. And they had a big responsibility to try to protect my mother. My mother... she kind of manipulated them in order to, so she didn't abuse them too much, the older brothers, because she wanted them to be on her side so that she would keep, that she would have them as a security, like, you know, to keep my dad away from her,
yeah,
which they did. And then they would get
protecting her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
protected
right.
Her, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, she allowed them to do drugs around the house. They were allowed to drop out of school. They got to do, you know, whatever they wanted to do, basically, because she wanted to keep them on, you know, on her good side, right? And my dad then would beat them up because they were trying to stop him from raping her, so they would be beaten up by him. And, you know, the fights that were going on were just ridiculous. It was just horrific, horrible, horrible situation. And they got into some criminal activity, my older brothers, just not my sister, my older brothers did, and they did some horrible things. So from zero to like 10, it was just a nightmare. My dad used to threaten to take me to California, just me. He would get me in the car and he'd drive and he'd say, let's just leave your mom, you and me. Well, because my mom was beating on me, you know. So he was thinking he could get me on his side, you know, to leave my mom. And he'd be like, you know, me and you, we'll move to California. We'll leave your mother and we'll leave all everything behind and we'll just go to California. And I told him I'd just jump out of the car. I would just open up the door and I'd be like, I'm gonna jump out of the car if you don't turn it around and go home. You know what I mean? It's like, as much as I didn't, you know, I wasn't happy the way that my mom was treating me at all. And I, you know, I was miserable, but I trusted my mom to take care of me more than my dad. I kind of figured my dad might kill me. I was worried about that. So I laugh about it now, but it was absolutely horrific. And, you know, to think that these two people who, when they were brought up on child abuse charges, had the opportunity to get help and turned it down. They were, because they had to go through these psych tests, they were told that they had to have counseling. You know, they needed counseling in order for us to stay in the home. And,
right.
You know, they needed marital counseling, family counseling. We all needed counseling, they said. And they went to
sure.
two sessions, and that's it. Yeah, two sessions.
Right.
And
right.
throughout
let
those
me,
years.
Let me ask you.
Yeah.
Let me ask you. Yeah. I want to talk about throughout those years, but I want to talk about it from the perspective of the little girl Lori was. Because
yeah.
that's the focus of tonight's show. We're going to emphasize that a little more. Think about how it was growing up. You grew up in this family where the domestic violence was actually generations old, you know, the domestic abuse of all different kinds. And
mm-hmm.
you had all these siblings that were older than you. When you came along, not only was it common, but it was, you know, it was just the way the family operated, I guess. But
yeah.
Lori must
well,
have
yeah.
had her own perspective on that. Did you have... Tell us a little bit about your perspective as a youngster now, with no power or authority. Maybe you didn't even know it was wrong. And I just want to hear a little bit about your thinking and how you felt at that age, okay, at the young age first.
Yeah, because I can remember, I have pretty good memories. Like, my memories go back to about 4 years old, and I have, like, clear mm-hmm. memories. And I had a lot of fear. Like I was saying, I was had a lot of anxiety, a lot of nervous tics in the house at any given time. And because it was always a fight, you know, the fights would break out like all the time. We never sat at the same table to eat. My mom would feed everybody at different times because she didn't want anybody at the table with my dad. There was all this stuff going on, like, you know, because just to try to keep the fights from happening, but they would anyway. And I used to feel sympathy, I guess. I wouldn't have even called it as a little child. I wouldn't have called it sympathy. I wouldn't have known what that word was. I really loved my parents, and I felt sad for them. You know, I was sad myself, but you know, just from having to grow up in this situation. But I felt a lot of sadness
yeah.
for them because my mom was always crying,
sure.
and you know, she'd be crying, and I'd see her with bruises and scratches, and you know, black eyes, and I'd just be like, I felt so bad for her. And then I'd listen to my older brothers, and especially my older brothers. My sisters never really had much to say to my mom, but my older brothers would talk to my mom. They'd be like, you know, you should leave him. You should just leave dad. You can leave us all. We don't, you know, whatever, if you don't want to take us with you, but you go, you get out, you know, or we can all go and we'll all leave him. You know
right.
what I mean? But she
right.
wouldn't listen
yeah.
to him. And I would be listening to these conversations at the age of, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, and sitting there just thinking, yeah, you know, that's what mom should do. You know, we should leave him, right? So in my mind, I was always kind of on my mom's side, even though my mom was my main abuser physically, especially. Well, in every way, really. I was still on her side because I knew what he was doing to her was wrong. And
right.
I don't know how I knew that, but I think it's because when you see somebody suffering, then you know that the person who's inflicting that suffering is doing wrong. And when my
right.
dad raped my, especially when my dad raped my mother in front of me that night, you know, I knew that was wrong because she couldn't get away from them. You know, and she was screaming. You know, it was kind of like, obviously a small child knows these things, even if they're not, you know, book trained and they don't have all the latest information from the DB websites. They know this stuff.
Right, and what age are you roughly? You're in grade school when this is going on, something like that.
Definitely like first, second grade. You know, just a young, you know, 5-6 years old. I started school early, which was because the social workers told my mom to put me in school early to make, you know, to get me out of the house, right, get me into some normal type situations. And I'd be at school sitting there all day, worried that maybe my mom would kill my dad in self-defense or my dad would kill my mother. That was always a fear. I used to have dreams about it, you know, that my sister would come to school and pick me up and tell me that some, you know, my mom killed my dad or my dad killed my mom. Or that was always a fear of mine, that one of them would kill the other one. And, you know, it's just scary. It was a horrible situation to grow up in. Absolutely. But I used to keep track of who was right and who was wrong, because I knew there was, you know, somebody was causing the pain. And, you know, it was kind of like, who's causing the pain? So I kind of kept track.
Did your siblings, especially the ones that were perhaps closer to you, try to protect you or try to explain it in a way that you could have understood? Or was that just you were on your own?
No. Yeah, no, I was on my own. And my sister is the oldest, the next oldest to me. She's the next, I guess, closest in age. She's 6 years older than me. So, and she had to share everything with me. So she just didn't want, she didn't treat me like a little sister. I was kind of this nuisance.
Right.
She was stressed out herself. I mean, we all were stressed right out. So I totally understand. You know, I don't, you know, I couldn't really expect anything else, I suppose. Sometimes siblings will come together to protect each other, but not in our family. There was only two that bonded.
Right.
And two of my brothers bonded. The rest, everybody else was kind of enemies, really. Yeah.
Wow.
Because we would use, everybody would use everybody against each other. Yeah.
Let me stop for a moment so that we can just have a comment from Darlene and William.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll come back, and you're
sure.
Still in your childhood at that point. But let's go to them and just get a from them, because I know they want to say hello.
Yeah.
All right, Darlene, why don't you go first?
Hey, you are doing a great job explaining this.
Well, thank you, Darlene.
I went through a lot of similar situations, but it was different, you know, and that my dad was in the military and nobody ever hardly did anything. Nobody protected, and all they would do is put him in the brig a little bit. And back then, you know, they didn't protect the kids no matter what.
Oh, it's true.
What?
Back in those days, they didn't really, you know.
And can you imagine, you know, you might think it's your sister what trying to bond with you, but then it might, we don't know what she endured after your brothers, you know, before you came along.
That's right.
That's what a
friend of mine actually told me that. Yeah. I had never thought of it before. And a friend of mine a few years ago had said, you know, you never know what she went through before you were born. Obviously bad, right? So give kind of some slack. I'm like, okay, I guess, you know. Yeah. So
might have got trained not to share with nobody. She might have tried to share with her brother and then got reprimanded for it and beat for it, you know, so she might have been afraid to act upon it, you know.
That's true. Yeah.
So we never know,
good
you
point
know.
There. Good
yeah,
point.
Yeah,
because
she doesn't
you are strong. Did you ever blame yourself?
No, that's one thing that I didn't do, and that's kind of interesting because I know that a lot of survivors do kind of take, just from what I've read, you know, I've done extensive reading on the subject, and a lot of children will take on the blame, say, oh, it must be me, you know, maybe they're fighting because of me, or maybe this whole mess is because of me. My parents used to blame me and tell me that it was because of me. They did, especially when they were beating on me. They'd be like, "This is all your fault, you know. This family's a mess because of you, you know, whatever." I actually used to just ignore it because I was like, obviously it's not because of me. Like, come on, people. I'm smarter than
all
that.
Right.
I'm not causing problems.
Let's go ahead and get a comment from William so we, you know, reserve some time for you to continue your story. William,
yeah.
What would you like to say to Lori?
It's an interesting story, and I can relate to some of that stuff from the back in the older days, because there were a lot of things that went on back in the old days, and it was like you take whatever, suck it up, and move on. And they didn't really protect anybody. You just like you learn to get tougher, you to survive or else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like the type of things that Lori's talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you both for the comment. I don't want to take too much time away from Lori because she's got a lot to tell us, I know, and a huge perspective on this. So, Lori, let me give it back to you. And if you would continue with, you're still in your youth, and maybe you're going to move into adolescence with this block and so forth, so we can get a feeling
yeah.
for what it was like being a child who grew up in a domestic violence home.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. We'll move on to, kind of like preteens and teens. Like my brothers did drugs around the house and stuff, and I never wanted anything to do with drugs because they, they would overdose and stuff, and I always felt kind of bad that, you know, they were involved in drug use. But I actually took it on at the age of 12 because I was like, I didn't care anymore. By the time I hit around 12 years old, I had just been through too much and seen too much, and I was just needing an escape. And so I decided to sort of start using drugs, which was my decision. Nobody pushed them on me because I had swore before that I'd never touch them. Right. I was against drugs. And then all of a sudden I was like, no, I need drugs. So give me drugs. So, you know, I started experimenting with pot, you know, marijuana and stuff, and just drinking here and there and stuff. But it quickly escalated into other things. And I was just so kind of lost, you know. My parents were still fighting, like, all the way through. They never stopped. I used to try to protect my mom as well, especially once I got older. Like, when I hit about 9, 10 years old, my mom had surgery when I was 9. She had to have a major, massive surgery done on her to fix some problems with her intestines and stuff. And she was very sick, and they thought she was going to die. So we had to go and say goodbye to her just in case. And she survived. They sent her home, and she had to recuperate and recover, but she was in bed for weeks. And my dad was in bothering her one night. She was kind of yelling and screaming at him to get out. And I thought, oh, my God, he's going to kill her. You know, he's going to, like, rape her, or, you know, she's going to cause her to die. So I got upset. This was when I was 9. And I took a pink plastic bat in, and I smacked him in the back of the head with it, like, really hard. And I'm just laughing now, but I tell you, I wasn't laughing then. And because I seriously thought that he could kill her, her stitches would bust. You know, she had an infection from the surgery. She wasn't doing well, and I thought, you know, she could die, right? I said, why didn't he just leave her alone? And that's so. I went behind him and I said, leave her alone. And I smacked him in the head with his bat. It was plastic. And really, at the time when I was that age, I didn't care if it was plastic or not. I just had a pink plastic bat, and I hit him with it. And so I was thrown across the room into a wall, which injured my back. And he had already injured my hip at a previous beating. So I was kind of just getting more and more injured all the time in every way. It was horrific. And so by the time I was and my mom didn't appreciate it. You know, that I had tried to stand up for her. But I thought it was the right thing to do. So even though, you know, I kind of felt bad about hitting my dad in the back of the head, it was kind of a wake-up call for him, like, hey, there's still somebody watching out, you know what I mean? I'm going to watch out for her now. And so, because I'm not really a violent person, coming from a violent home, I don't like, I hate violence. So that was a drastic measure. But my mom didn't appreciate it, and the physical abuse just kept going on. Their fighting continued on. Nothing really changed. A lot of my siblings had moved out at this time. By the time I was 10, two more of my brothers had moved on. One had sexually abused me as a child, which I won't even you know, I'll just mention here, I've actually done a show here on that before, but, you know, I was just kind of a shell, like a walking shell. By the time I hit 13, I just remember feeling very different than other people. I had some good friends that I hung around with on the block that I grew up on. And these people knew my parents' situation. It was bizarre to grow up on this block because we lived on this block for many years. People knew that we were just the Crazy Smith family, right? And all of the siblings
right.
that spilled out of the house were just the Crazy Smith kids. And so my parents actually had lots of friends. They were not the type, like they weren't drinkers, they weren't drug addicts, they weren't alcoholics. They were just bent on making each other's lives a miserable experience. It was horrible. And so, you know, my mom would cry the blues to the neighbors, you know, warden this and my, you know, her talking about her husband, my dad. And then, you know, the neighbors, of course, would, you know, support my mother. She had lots of support. And then my children, you know, she'd run down her children. My children are this and my children are that, you know, driving me crazy. And Lori, she's just too much to handle. And actually, I was a really good kid. I avoided trouble because I didn't want to get beat on. And so I stayed very kind of, you know, trouble-free for a long time. I didn't cause any problems. I didn't have any kind of – I didn't act up in school because I was abused or anything like that. I didn't want any more beatings. And so I really tried to toe the line and stay out of trouble, even though I was using drugs and stuff. My mom would have killed me had she found out, really. So I kept that very, very, you know, covert. But it was – she just – wanted somebody to blame, you know, for all of this stuff. And so she got a lot of support from a lot of people. So these neighbors, they all loved my mom. And, you know, they knew my dad was somewhat crazy and I think felt sorry for him. Didn't care one two hoots about the children. So there's my siblings, my brothers, my sisters, and me all growing up in this situation. And just being completely overlooked, absolutely completely overlooked. It was all about my mom and it was all about them, you know what I mean? It was absolutely horrific. So my siblings, they got involved in some criminal activity. Some of them ended up in prison, some of them nothing too violent, but just robberies and this type of things for drugs, right? And one of my siblings actually, so family violence was an issue in our home, like not just violence between my parents, but one of my brothers raped me for about a year, sexually abused me. And another brother, a different brother, actually held a knife to my sister's throat to get her to take him on a drug run so he could rob a pharmacy to get drugs and was going to cut her throat. He was going to kill her. Yeah. And I remember I was about 12 years old and 12, 13 I was. And I had to talk him into into not cutting our sister's throat. I was like, you know, I had to figure out a way to reach him because he was high, like really, really messed up on drugs. And my sister was just freaking out. He had the knife to her throat, and she ended up having to drive him because he forced her to drive him to this pharmacy so he could rob it. But she just dropped him off and left and split. So he dropped his wallet, and the FBI came right to the house, right? But anyway, my mom would have never called the police.
He's a bright one.
He was just so messed up. The only brother. He was the one that was the closest in age to me. He was 7 years older than me, and he had done way too many drugs, had too many overdoses, but he was just so lost, that guy. And two of my brothers ended up committing suicide, and he was one of them. He was just a mess, that poor guy. But my parents, nobody phoned the police, you know. That's not what you did in my house. You just dealt with it. It's like my mom knew that the CSA, the child sexual abuse, was going on. She did nothing to stop it. And about a year after, like it went on for about almost a year, about I'd say 8-9 months. And then my mom sent my brother away with a one-way ticket. That was her answer. Just get rid of him, send him up to Canada. He can rape other girls, right? I have no idea, you know what I mean, if he sexually abused anybody else or not. And she just gave him a one-way ticket and was like, bye, and, you know, there you go. Get rid of the trouble. So I didn't, I saw him again because he had tried to commit suicide, and he did come back to stay at our house for a bit, which was very uncomfortable for me. But he didn't try anything again, but it was still just having him in the house was just really scary because of what had happened, right? And it was just a horrific situation. My mom, I was, so through my teens in school, I still used to think my parents would kill each other. I was pretty sure of it. I was like, one day my mom's just going to kill my dad, because my mom would bash my dad over the head with really heavy things to try to get him away from her. And I was like, one day she's just going to crack his skull open, you know, in some sort of self-defense thing. Yeah, or my dad's just going to kill my mom. It was just always in the back of my mind. And because they were continually fighting, physically fighting. And I remember being 16. And I mean, I used to be at this point very angry. After about the age of 10, I just wanted, I recognized that I was dead, spiritually dead, emotionally dead. I was just dead. They had killed me. And I was just like, you can go. My mom used to threaten to kill me. I'd be like, go ahead and kill me. I don't care. You've already killed me. You know, that's whatever. Just finish it off, you know.
Right.
So I used to say stuff, and then I'd get beaten even more. But this, I felt somewhere deep inside of me, I really still felt bad for my parents. I really did. Because I loved them, and I didn't want to see them suffer. I didn't want anybody to suffer, my family. I loved my family. But part of me, the other bigger part of me, was very, very angry. And, you know, I was already a teenager headed for trouble using drugs. And took a lot of my anger out just on crazy behavior. So I started driving very crazy. I got a car at the age of 16. Used to stay away, you know, for long periods of time, go do drugs, party, check in with my mom once in a while, you know, this sort of thing. And was not doing well, like not doing well at all.
Well, now,
and I had,
let me point something out to the audience in case they missed it. You were 7 years younger than your closest sibling. So a considerable amount of probably all the way through almost, like middle school and grade school and high school, you were left alone in the house with your parents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was the last
one.
So I was my mom's target for abuse, because I was the only one left in the house. And my sister would be gone. Like she was always with her friends, or she'd be working. My oldest brother, he was always gone, and two of them had already moved out. So yeah, most the siblings were pretty well gone by the time I was a young teen. My sister was still living at home until I was 16, and then she got married. So
and let me just be clear in my mind, Laurie. I know at some point, although the family was originally from Canada, it moved to the United States. Can you refresh my memory as to what this is all happening in New Mexico?
Oh, yeah, sorry, I sort of skipped that. Yeah, they moved to New Mexico 5 years before I was born. My sister was 6 years older than me. Yeah, so they moved in. When my sister was a baby, moved down there. So I was born there. I was born
in
the States. Yeah.
Right. All right,
and,
so you're a teenager all alone. You don't have your siblings to ask questions of or rely on or whatever. They're gone. Probably ran as fast as they could, most of them.
and so
how did you make your way in adolescence? How was that? What did that feel like? What was your thinking there, you know, in your teenage years?
You know, that's the thing. I really relied a lot on my friends. My friends were my closest allies, you know. I spent a lot of time with my friends and even would stay at their homes and stuff all the way through my early teens, like 12, 13 and up. And I used to be, you know, sometimes stay with them for days, you know, if not weeks, and off and on. And they were, like, I used to try to gain knowledge from their parents, especially because these these friends of mine had decent parents, you know, and I didn't trust adults, period. But I trusted them more than I trusted my own parents, because I knew that they didn't beat their children, and they didn't try to kill each other. Right? So I was like, okay, these guys have a better sense in their heads, you know. I try to learn from them. One of my older sisters at this time, by the time I hit, I'd say mid-teens or so, she was established, my oldest sister. She had, they had a business and they had a house, and they would invite my parents for dinner and me, because there was nobody else involved, really. My other sister was doing her own thing, early marriage, you know, she was doing her own thing. So it would be my parents and me would be going over for dinner. But she would tell them before they came over, she'd be like, look, you know, this is my house, and you're not going to fight here. You're going to behave yourself here, because she knew that they would start their stuff, and it's, you know, at her house too. She was like, you're not doing that at my house. You do, we already know what you do at home, but you're not doing it here. So as soon as my parents would, they'd fight the whole way over there, and then as soon as we'd go in their house, they'd have to behave themselves. So it was actually quite enjoyable, because we'd sit for a couple hours of enjoyable time together. But then as soon as we got back in the car to go home, it would all start again, right? And this went on for, you know, till my mom died. Really, literally. It was just absolutely ridiculous.
How did you, so to speak, escape the home? By going to school or marrying, or what did you do?
I stayed away from home as often as I could. You know what I mean? Like my parents, went before I hit, I'd say about 15, so, you know, 12 to 15, I was out doing drugs, and my parents didn't even care where I was from like 12 to 15.
See.
They didn't care if I came home. They didn't care. My mom didn't want me around the house. My mom was beating on me. Right. I had an intervention done during that period, because my mom was, she had beat me up badly, actually. And I went to a friend's, and my friend's parents intervened, and my mom was like, I don't care, you know, I don't want her here anyway. Yeah. So they were threatening to call the cops and report the abuse. And she was like, well, go ahead. I don't care.
Let's go to Darlene and William for a couple of quick comments, then we'll come back. But what a fabulous story. The perspective you're giving us is great, being a kid, and having to defend herself, figure it out for herself, feel its way through. And when we come back, I want to move into your young adulthood. Whatever you did, you know, through the end of high school and into the next period of time. But let's wrap up your childhood, your real childhood, with a question or a comment from Darlene, and then one for William. Darlene, you're up first.
Yes. I wondered if you had any aunts or uncles or cousins who were around you at any of this time?
No. They were – that's a good question. All of my cousins, all of my aunts and uncles all live in Nova Scotia. And so my parents moved to – New Mexico just before I was born, like about 4 or 5 years before I was born. And so they left Canada behind and moved to a state that they knew absolutely nobody in. They moved to New Mexico, and there was no family down there. So we grew up on our own down there, and lived on this one block for the whole time. So the block was this universe, you know, that we lived in, and there was nobody else. So it was kind of isolated, very strange. And the siblings, I keep saying that, the cousins and stuff, they were dealing with their own stuff, because my parents were born in these big families. My mom had seven younger siblings. My dad was a family of 9 children. And they were all had their own problems as well, which I didn't know about until many years later. They contacted me after they saw that my books and saw that they saw my stuff, because I don't keep in touch with them. Uncles, well, actually all my aunts and uncles are gone now because they're really old. Like my parents were born in the 20s, so that just tells you. My cousins, some of them are still living, and they're even much older than me because I'm the youngest. And so they're, you know, hitting 70, right? So they're like, they've asked me some questions because they were like, well, what do you know? You know, because we experienced this and this and this, right? And I'm like, wow, well, I only know this, this, and this. You know what I mean? So they had their own set of problems to deal with their own parents, because my parents were brought up in these abusive homes.
Right.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, that was a good question, actually.
William,
thank you.
A comment or a question from you? William?
Yeah.
You might be on mute.
She was born when they moved out to New Mexico. I know a little something about that because I come from, like, West Texas. And you're really out on your own out there. You know, the community that you live in is really your support network, because that's all there is out there.
Yeah.
It's not like living in the big cities and stuff.
That's
true. Your friends and things, what you're going to have to depend on, because there is nothing out in some of those places in New Mexico.
Yeah, I was born in Albuquerque, so I was born in the city there. But
well, you're lucky that way.
it's a big city in New Mexico, but still, it's still small, and it's still small-minded.
Right, but I'm
like
talking
small,
like some of the other little outlying cities, you know, where that last chance Mexico is, nothing for 280 miles.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty sparse.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
a beautiful area.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You're welcome.
All right. So we're going back to Lori now, and you're going to continue on if you would. We have about 40 minutes left, so we got plenty of time. But now crossing into adulthood, the second part of what I said we would talk about is not just how you experienced it as a child, but how it affected your adulthood. The fact that you grew up in a domestic violence home. So that's the next section I'd like you to cover, however you'd like to do it. Impact of the trauma from your childhood as you're trying to learn what it is to be an adult in the adult world. What was that like?
It was difficult. And, you know, I mean, I'm still struggling. Maybe I always will be struggling with some things and, you know, having to figure things out. But it was very difficult. Like I said, I wasn't in denial, but I definitely was using the escape of drugs, you know, to sort of mask the pain and mask the problems until I hit about 21 years old. At 21, I decided I didn't want to end up dead in the gutter somewhere, so I just cut the drugs out. I actually did quit using drugs, and which was probably the best thing I could have ever done. And decided that I did want to live, you know, I wanted to try to have a better life. My parents, by the time I hit my, like, their last physical fight, really, was that I knew about, unless they had fought sometime when I didn't see it, was right around 16, 17. So they were still verbally, emotionally, psychologically abusive towards each other, but the physical stuff had stopped by the time I was 17. So at least that one aspect was a little better, but they were still, you know, my mom would still throw things at my dad and they would curse each other. And it was horrible. My mom didn't want me to move out. Like, I was about ready to move out at the age of 17 because we weren't obviously not getting along. We never got along. And I wanted my freedom. I was looking to get out and move out. And my mom was like, Well, if you move out, who's going to protect me from your dad? This was always the issue. It was always about her, you know what I mean? And I was like, well, you know, I did what I could to protect you, and you didn't even appreciate it. I took beatings for it, you know? I mean, I got my back smashed in for that, you know, and my head caved in. So, you know, I've done what I could, you know what I mean? Like, this was kind of my attitude, especially heading towards 18. And I told her, I said, besides that, who was there to protect me from my brother Rob, you know, raping me? I just told her like it was, you know. And I was just about ready to move out, and I had a bad car accident. And this car accident was horrible. It was my fault. I hit some gravel and water and spun out, and three of my friends were in the vehicle. We all were injured. Nobody died, thank God, but it was horrible. And I, you know, I would never wish to hurt my friends ever, right? But it threw me out of commission because now I was $20,000 in debt. I had a broken ankle, had some pretty bad bodily injuries there from this accident. And I was going to be on crutches for like a year. I was going to be on crutches actually for 2 years, cast for a year and crutches for two, and rehab and everything. So my parents at this point, my mom was like, well, you could stay here, see, because she didn't want me to move out. She wanted somebody there to protect her from my dad. My mom was a codependent. And so she, you know what I mean, everything, she manipulated everything, right? But I could kind of sort of see through her a little bit there. I knew why she was doing this. But she actually, for the first time, started to try to be nice to me at the age of 18 when I had this car accident, which was just blew my mind. It absolutely blew my mind. Because before, my mom had beaten on me and abused me horrifically in every way. You know, I mean, it was just ridiculous. So I go into detail in my books and on my website if anybody wants to check that out. But I couldn't believe, you know, that her attitude would change towards me. And I some friends of mine, just shortly after I had gotten... This was my mentality. I was not thinking at all. You know, I've just had this car accident. I'm on Demerol. My friends decide to throw me a party because I survived this accident. And we all started drinking at like 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm on crutches. I can't even stand up on these things. We all drank a huge bottle each. We all had a huge bottle each of what our favorite whatever. And I was so tanked, you know, by the time noon came around, I was passed out in the gutter in the middle of the street, you know, with my crutches. I couldn't stand up. I was on drugs. I was using Demerol, so drinking at the same time, very dangerous. And so I was very, very sick. And to make a long story short, that night when I went home, and I was really, really sick. And my mom was like, well, look what you're doing to yourself. Look what you're doing to your life. You're ruining your life. This is what my mom was telling me in my bedroom as I'm laying on the bed, you know, with my leg in a cast. Just come out of the hospital, drunk, you know, still drunk. And my mom's telling me this, and this light bulb went off in my head. I was like, look what I'm doing to myself. I was like, what are you talking about, you know? I was like, look what you've done to me. You know, and I just laid it out on the line. I said, you did this. Look what you've done. You and Dad, you know. And I was like, look what you did to all of us. It just hit me that, she, you know, she was going to turn this on me as if, oh, I've just ruined my life. And I was like, you ruined my life. I said, you and Dad ruined my life when I was born. And she did not want to hear that. Let me tell you. Oh man, you know, talk about truth hurts, you know. And she left the room, but I'm so glad that I got to have my say there, because I was like, you know, you did this. I mean, okay, I went out drinking and I'm, you know, I fell down in the gutter today. Well, whatever. The issue is you screwed my life up. This is why I'm the way that I am, you know. And so you know, I'm glad that I told her that. So long story short, I still continue to party. I do drugs until the age of 21. But I work, you know, I'm able to work. I'm a high-functioning drug addict. I have three jobs. I work on crutches. I'm just, you know, determined to try to make it. And my mom's health starts going downhill, you know, about the time I hit 20, 21. My mom's 38 years older than me. And she's getting sicker, you know, and I decide to get off the drugs, and I'm still living at home with my abuser parents, and I'm like, I have no clue how to do life. I know how to party with my friends, you know, I know how to get high, I know how to do drugs, and I can keep a job. I know how to behave at work, because I can behave well to keep my job, you know, and but I don't know how to do life, and I don't even know how to do me. I don't even know who I am, you know? And So as a young person, I mean, I never went on dates. I never had a date because I feared intimacy, because not only from my parents' physical abuse towards each other and the domestic violence, but because I was sexually abused as a child. And just the whole idea of intimacy just didn't make any sense to me. Intimacy is pain, you know. That's what people do to each other. They hurt each other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what domestic
right.
violence does to children. It shuts them down, you know what
right.
I mean. They're, so I got involved at the age of 23, had my first relationship. Before, I had never had a date ever before this, right? But I met this guy. And we fell in love. We were together for about 2 years. But he was a recovering alcoholic. And I mean, we were totally in love with each other. And he had so many problems. He grew up abused himself. He never dealt with any of his stuff. I never dealt with any of mine. And before he actually started abusing me, we cut it off. We broke
mm-hmm.
off. The relationship, which was good, because I'm sure it would have come to that. So I'm not a victim of domestic violence, but I'm a victim of secondhand domestic violence. But it could have gone that way so easily because boundaries. I had no idea what healthy boundaries are, you know, and that they need to be set. They're very important. So I had so many problems as a young, you know, person in my 20s, just trying to do this normal thing, trying to live, you know. And
right.
I wanted
right.
to enjoy life, you know. I wanted to find some peace and some happiness. But I used to. I actually moved to the Grand Canyon for a year and went and worked out there. And this was when I was 26. So after I broke off with that guy that had been with for 2 years, roughly 2 years, it was almost a 2 year relationship. I ended up going to the Grand Canyon to get some space in between me and my parents again, you know, and. It was good that I did that, but I did get to see then that I had a lot of problems with suicidal ideation, because the whole time I was out there, I was just thinking about killing myself.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I could do it, because my parents were suicidal. My mom had suicidal ideation. My dad was actually suicidal. And so I just thought, you know, and two of my brothers were suicidal and ended up killing themselves. So it was just always in my mind, you know, and I used to sit out there and I'd just cry and cry and cry in the middle of the night, you know, nobody around, Grand Canyon, pitch black, and just looking up at the stars, just wondering what this is all about. You know, this life, it shouldn't just be all
right.
about pain. It shouldn't just be all about torment, you know.
Right.
I wanted something better. And I started to realize, especially around the age of 27, 28, that I needed to leave, get completely away from my parents' grasp completely and go and get my own life. So I moved to Canada. At the age of 30, like 29, and I took all of my problems with me up here. You know, I thought I was leaving my problems behind and running, you know, again, running to get away from my problems, just a 2,000-mile run. And I thought, you know, I could leave all that baggage behind, but actually I just carried all that baggage with me. It just came with me, right?
Right.
That's the next portion
right.
of the situation. My adult life, it's been difficult for sure to navigate. And
all right.
I hit.
I just wanted to let you know we have about 25 minutes left, so just to pace
mm-hmm.
yourself. You're doing great.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Before you go any
well,
further,
thank you. I appreciate
you've
that.
You've mentioned a couple of times books and other things that you know you have available, and in the description of tonight's show for you, we have the Facebook page Protecting Our Children under your name. Is that a good place for people to go to seek out information on your books and so forth? Or is there a better place?
No.
Just tell us if there is.
Yeah, like my books, I wrote 3 books, and they're available on Lulu and Amazon. And I don't push my book sales, you know what I mean? Because I didn't write them for
okay.
money. But just so everybody
okay.
knows that the books that I wrote, all the proceeds will go to NASCA. So any
okay.
sales, because I don't want the money for those books at all. And so
anything
I make from them, I just.
Lori Ann Smith at Amazon and they'll pull up the books?
You can, yeah, if you just type in my name, Lorianne Smith, and just type in child abuse advocate, anything to do with child abuse,
okay.
My name associated with it,
okay.
It'll come up, yeah.
And,
right.
I just didn't
want to
skip over offering that on the air, you know, at all.
Oh, I appreciate
so,
that.
All right, now we'll go back.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, I do
we'll
appreciate
go back
it.
To
and
where
like
you
I said,
were,
I...
Where you were and... I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, Lori.
Well, no, that's okay. Yeah, this is, it was tough. You know, I at the age of 30, I was actually very happy to get away from my parents. My mom was very sick, you know, when I left, and she didn't want me to move up to Canada, but all my family is Canadian, so I wanted to be Canadian too, and that was my excuse for leaving. And so I just told her, you know, goodbye. She didn't say anything to me. Best wishes or I love you, which I knew. See, we had a huge blowout before I moved up here, but I won't even go into the details of that. But that's where I actually found out the truth from her, was that she never wanted any of us and that she didn't want children. She didn't want any of us. I told her, so you put us through all of this for nothing. You know, I was just
right.
Like 6 months before moving up here, had a huge blowout with her. And, you know, I said, you could have gone, when you and Dad were brought up on child abuse charges, at that point, you could have let us all go. We could have gone into foster care. I said, but instead of that, you put us through all of this for nothing. I said, you have to tell
right.
us that we counted for something. And she said, you didn't count for anything. So I was
ouch.
Like, at that point, I already knew. See, I mean, I already knew this, right? But I had been holding on to, like a little young child would, just holding on, you know, to this idea and this thought that their parent, that their mother loved them. You know what I mean? And that she
right.
really did love me, and that she really didn't want to hurt me. And it was just this thing I had always been hoping that I would get what I needed from her, and you know, I would forgive her, and that you know she would tell me that she loved me, and you know this sort of thing. And when she threw that at me, I was like, you know, I already knew that, right? I said, but
right.
the shame is on you because your children loved you. I said, all of your children loved you very much. And to me, that was my slap in her face. I was like, you know what? We all loved you. And shame on you for treating us like that, you know? So
she
I
really
left,
missed
like,
out, didn't
shortly
she?
After.
She really missed
she
out.
She did.
I mean,
see, they
know,
did. My parents
she had
missed out.
All these... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's how I started to see things
yeah.
differently. Like when I, after I moved up here, I ended up in a relationship with the man that I was married to for quite a few years, Cecil. And when we first started out, I had no idea how to do relationships. Relationships to me were a very distorted thing. And I was doing the same things that my mom was doing. So to make a long story short, we first got together and moved in together. I didn't trust him really, you know what I mean? Like I didn't trust anybody. But
we
hit it off, you know, and I did fall in love with him. And I thought, okay, I'm old enough now. I can look after myself. But immediately I started acting like my mom, you know, throwing dishes, cursing. You know, I don't like something that he said or, I think he's dissed me or disrespected me somehow, you know, or he's not doing what I want him to do, then I'm going to manipulate the situation and get, you know, get my needs met. I'm just doing the same things I watched my parents do. So I really did. I had no idea I was so screwed up. You know what I mean? So he was good about it. He was good about it. But I became pregnant shortly right into our relationship and lost the baby. So at that point, I decided to leave because I thought, you know, I got to get my head straight. I was on my own in the apartment when I lost the baby. And I thought, what am I doing? I'm with this guy. I don't even know. I'm in Canada. I just left my abuser parents. Like, I don't have a clue what I'm doing. I need to go get my head straight. So I left him and moved to Vancouver Island for a little while, for a short period of time, just to get my head straight. And, I mean, I had just lost my baby, and I did want the baby, and I was going to keep the baby. You know what I mean? I was, regardless of the situation, but I
right.
lost it, unfortunately. So...
Sure.
I had to go get my head straight. And so during this time when I was on Vancouver Island, my mom got sick and died. But I went, I had just lost my boyfriend, just lost my baby, and my mom's sick in the hospital dying. So I had to go down to see her. And I went down there and saw her on her deathbed, really. I mean, just the night before she went into a coma. But, you know, at that point, I stayed for the funeral, you know, and just for a few weeks, visited with friends and family, and then any family that was down there, which wasn't much. And then, because we're sort of dwindling, you know, people are dropping. And so I moved back up to Canada, but came to Calgary. And that year that I was in Calgary, I really missed Cecil, and I realized that I did care about him or I wouldn't have been with him. And so I contacted him, and he said he was just waiting for me to call. So this man loved me. Yeah, he was awesome. And we got back together, and so we spent a year apart, and we got back together, and I told him, before he came, I was freaking out because I'm like, oh, my God, you know, here I'm back in the same situation. I don't trust him. I don't trust myself. I don't trust anything to do with relationships. How are we going to do this? But I sat him down when he came to move in with me, and I talked to him for like 2 hours. And I said, look, you know, we're going to treat each other right. I'll just make the conversation quick. You know, I said we're going to do the right things by each other. I told him about everything. He knew about some of the abuse and especially the sexual abuse because I had to tell him about that because I've got intimacy problems. But you know. I have issues with that. So I did have to fill him in a bit, but he didn't know about all of it. And so I told him, you know, I said, look, you know, the reason I behave the way I am is because this is the way I grew up, you know? And I don't know. I want to be different. I said, but you need to be different
right.
too. You know, and I told him what I needed. I said, you know, I need somebody who's going to be here for me. I need somebody who's not going to hit me. I was afraid he was going to hit me. I was afraid he was going to start beating on me. That was always a fear of mine. You know what I mean? Because I fear intimate partner relationships, right? So
sure.
I just had to lay it on the line and tell him what I needed too. And then he talked to me for about an hour, and he said he told me what he needed, you know, and that he was, you know, he understood what I needed. And so we made a deal that we would never hurt each other, that we would always think of each other, you know, and keep each other's best interest at heart, and that we would never hurt each other. And sure enough, we made it. We made it through. And so that was very awesome. But, you know, it was tough at first. It really was. And because I had to learn how to change these behaviors, these learned behaviors of mine. And it took me, I mean, a long time. And I wasn't even really working on my healing journey. I was just working on trying not to throw things and become violent and calm down and, you know, think differently, right? And it was tough. So it's been hard. I didn't start my healing journey. We actually separated for 4 years. It was not a split because we were unhappy with each other or anything. It's just he was terminally ill, and he wanted to go into a place that had a nurse on site. For some reason, he just thought that would be best for him. And I was totally cool with it because he was terminally ill. He was dying. I said, you know, your needs have to come first. You have to do what makes you comfortable, you know. So he moved out, but we were still together, you know what I mean, in our hearts. And
yeah.
But I moved into
sure.
this place by myself. And it was at that point I hit my lowest point at the age of 42, and I spiraled down into a pit of depression and really was thinking about suicide, and I was suicidal ideation. So I was sitting on the couch considering it again for, you know, for the millionth time, and I thought, there's just something wrong with me. Like, I mean, I had flashbacks of all the beatings and the sexual abuse going on. I could hear my mom's voice, you know, screaming at me, and the name calling and just the insults and the abuse and the beatings and everything, all of it was just coming at me. I was having a breakdown. And so I thought, how long do I have to take this? You know, like, they're already gone. My mom's dead. You know, how long do I have to deal with this? And, you know, this isn't even my fault, like all this stuff that happened to me. But I did that night make a decision that was the best decision I ever made, which was to get help. You know, and to start reaching out. And so that's what I did. And so I didn't start any real work on it for about 2 years into it, like, because I didn't even know what direction to go. But I did start
right.
to take a look at what I was going to have to do to heal from all this. And so that's where I'll pick up with this next part with my
mm-hmm.
healing journey. Because I started
all
to
right.
realize, like, I needed to think differently. Yeah.
Sure, sure. All right, let's get a couple of comments in so we have time when we need for your healing journey.
Sure.
Darlene, you would be up next, please.
Yes. So sorry you had to endure that. I am so happy that you did find love, and that is kind of like a happy ending in a way, you know. That you.
Thank you.
I'm glad y'all worked it out and got back together. That's such a sweet love story, you know.
It is. Thank you. I appreciate it. It is, and you know, I cherish it. You know, he passed away 2 years ago, and from that terminal illness. But you know, we had we were best friends, and we had right up until the day he was going, the very day that he was going, we enjoyed each other's company, and we just loved being together. That was the best gift he could give to me, was himself and his love. You know, so.
And he did.
So
that,
it was a very, very happy ending. Yeah.
That's awesome, you know. That kind of love is hard to find, so I'm so glad found that.
It is, and I feel really blessed to be able to, you know, that I was able to have that, right? Huge gift.
Oh,
and I don't take it lightly at all, you know. So.
And enough, you know, kids. Just letting the people that's listening know, you know, kids are a gift from God. You know, we're not no burden. We're, you know, if your parents didn't want you, you know, you are a gift, and so were your siblings. You know, and so were your parents and their parents and all. You know.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that they were treated.
True.
And like, you know, I don't pass on the traits of my family because I didn't want. Treat my kids how I was treated. Well, I stopped that, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But,
yeah, that's just right. Not everyone will abuse their children that was abused. Yeah.
Right on.
No.
Okay, thank
you.
That's awesome.
Let's go to let's get a quick comment from William, and then we'll finish up. Yeah, thank you, Darlene. William?
Yeah, that's true. One of the things that people, and that's the worst part about abuse and that, is the father and mother should be loving their children and stuff. But I know there's a lot of things that come up and issues in that too with relationships and things because of stuff like this. And it makes it hard and rough on the kids when they're growing up. And it causes problems for them too when they grow up and start moving into their adult relationships and things. So that's another problem there too. And I suffered some of that because my ex-wife, well, she was my wife at the time, but she had been abused in her family, so it caused problems in our relationship later.
It's hard if those things aren't dealt with, absolutely. And that's the thing. I know when I started working on my on myself, you know, to change some of these learned behaviors and stuff that I had going on and anxiety and stuff, you know, it really made a difference in our relationship. And unless the couple is willing to work on it, it doesn't happen. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, William. Let's get back to Lori and finish up her story with her healing journey, where she is today. You got about 11 minutes left, Lori.
Yeah. Well, I started just looking into the issues. You know, I started to write a blog, actually, and that's became my book, A Life of Death Through Redemption. And I just started writing through my eyes at, like, the age of 13, looking back at the abuse and then looking forward. And then that was very helpful, just to not have to carry the load myself. It became very empowering because all of a sudden – you know, I have a voice. I realized, you know, I don't have to be quiet. I don't have to. I can tell the truth about what happened. You know what I mean? It was very empowering for me to be able to do that. But I also started right about the same time doing a blog talk radio show, and I did that for a long time. And it was my healing journey. I would do the talks that I was giving was basically the stuff that I was working on for my healing journey. So I worked on my healing journey for years. I mean, I've been on it for 12 years now. And the books that I was using mainly that I found very helpful were John Bradshaw's Healing the Shame That Binds You and the other one, Homecoming Healing the the Inner Wounded Child, or whatever it's called. It's the two books that he has out. That one
right.
was really helpful. They both were, actually. And I did some
They're
work with...
Helpful.
Yeah.
I recommend both, frankly. Yeah.
Yeah. And the cause, I mean, I would do the work, like the journaling. I actually joined an anonymous web, like a online support group at first, because I just didn't know, you know, how the whole thing would work. And found that very helpful. So that was at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And then I just worked on certain things at a time. Like I would work on anger, you know, and why and what happened to me as a child, and work through the anger. And then I would work on the grief, you know, the stages of grief and loss and trauma.
Yeah.
I would just go through and do these sections. And while I was working on it, it was actually helping me to heal. So it was great. And I'm not saying oh, I'm just perfect and everything's great and I have no problems. And, you know, that's just silly. Life is a process and we have to keep going. I'm still working on some things, and I always will be. You know, I make mistakes, and I have to go back and correct it. But at least I'm starting to recognize now, you know, certain patterns of behavior that I still do, and I think, oh, okay, I see what I'm doing. You know what I mean? And I need to change that, right? Because
yes.
I'm the one losing out, pushing people away, or, you know, that same old thing of, you know, pushing people out of my life, which is really easy for me to do. Because I'm that young person, you know, I don't count. I'm just worthless, you know, going back to those same old behaviors. I'm useless. I'm worthless. You know, what do I need with the relationship? Just push people out. If I think people are going to start taking advantage of me, I'm real quick to push people out. And they may not even be trying to take advantage of me. That's just how I'm perceiving it. You know what I mean? I'm very cautious about things. And it's just from being abused. So I've probably got some issues, you know, still going on always that I need to work on. But I'm getting better at recognizing when I'm messing up or making these errors, these incorrect assumptions or whatever they are. It's kind of like, oh, okay, I see what I'm doing. And, you know, pushing love away, pushing people away, you know, instead of embracing it, right? And
right.
That sort of thing. I still have issues with that. And it's just from me being, that was my only way that I could say, okay, it was okay that my mom didn't love me, because I don't need love. You know what I'm saying? Like, as a young kid growing up, you know, a young child not receiving any love, then when people try to love me, I just push them away. Right? It's like, no, don't touch
right.
me. Don't love me. I'm not lovable. Right.
Right.
So I had to learn how to change the way I felt about myself. And that took a long time. It took work to do that. It wasn't just like I was woke up one day and said, oh, I've changed everything and I feel so much better. I had to go through the process of what do I think? You know, like, what are my thinking processes and what needs to change? So I did a lot of self-introspection without the aid of a therapist, just going through John Bradshaw's books. Robert Burney, he's another one. There's several good, therapists out there that have books out there that are really helpful.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's just the
yeah.
way that I went, but not what works for me might not work for somebody else. I also did that program that I talked about before, healing. It used to be called Forget Talking Therapy, but they changed the name to Your Envisioned Mind. Beverly Searle out of Australia. That's a great program. And that's a meditation that, you know, people can do, that you can go in and set up a safe place for yourself, for these inner wounded parts of ourselves. That made a huge difference to me, because I used to think inner children stuff was very strange, and I didn't trust it, but because I'm a Christian. But the thing is, I realize now that it totally works, because I have, and I still do have, all of these inner children that are at these different stages where I was wounded. And through the years now, because it's been many years since I went through that and did that program with them, most of them are healed. Like, most of them are, like, I don't even feel that they're there anymore. There's still a couple that are around, and they're the most wounded. And that's the 10-year-old, and she's still got a lot of anger. She's the result of all the abuse and the sexual abuse. And I'm still working with that part of myself. So there's still some healing work to be done, but I'm in such a better a better place, you know, than I ever was. And I think it's because I'm learning how to love life, you know, because I still find myself some days that are bad. You know, I have bad days just like everybody else. I find myself sometimes slipping back into this routine of, you know, oh, you know, this life's too hard. You know, I'm too tired, or I don't care anymore, or whatever. But I'm like, no, that's not true. That's not true at all. I do care. And I don't want to, like, I don't want to waste one day. I think that's what it all came down to.
Right.
That's what started to help my healing journey out, was that, you know, we're not promised tomorrow, right? We only have today. So how am I going to feel better today? So I started making these little changes and these little subtle things, yeah.
I'll tell you what, though. We have to kind of wrap things up here, but I have to tell you, from the day I met you, which is years ago now, you've always been lovable, always. This
aww.
Perspective that we have about ourselves is not accurate. Yet we think we're the authority on ourselves, and we're not. We can't see ourselves, really. So I just want to say to the people out there who may be thinking like this, and I feel the same way, and you and I have talked about it recently, that we're wrong. That's our brain trying to get us to accept a set of falsehoods about who we are.
Yeah.
But ask your friends who you are, and you'll find out. I will always tell Lori, I have loved her from the beginning. She's always been lovable. I've just been waiting for her to, start loving herself. I mean, that's really what it's about. You know, can we love ourselves? Can we figure out how to love ourselves? Because we are lovable.
Yeah.
We're worth it. We just don't feel that way. But we don't buy a feeling.
Yeah.
So keep going, all of us, and keep showing up. All right. Let's get a quick comment from Darlene, and then William, and then a final thought from Lori. Darlene, you're up.
Thank you so much for telling your story tonight. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Darlene. I appreciate you sitting here with me and spending this time with me. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was very special, Darlene and William. Thank you both for being here. William, your final thought?
Yeah, thank you for sharing your story, Lori. And don't be a stranger. And we do a lot of things and make a lot of other people aware of things that a lot of people aren't too familiar with it, but NASCA and the family and things help people become more aware of all this different stuff.
And
somebody's got to, you know, we're people that are making changes and helping others make those changes. So we're doing a good thing, and so are you.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, thank you for being here with me, William. I appreciate you spending this time with me.
You're welcome. You too.
Yes, thank you. Thank you both, Darlene and William. All right, Lori, that leaves you with about a minute for a final thought or so, roughly. So leave us with whatever you'd like, perhaps something inspirational, perhaps just reality.
Well, reality, I would say, you know, for survivors out there, wherever you are on your healing path, you know, wherever you're at in that, we're going to have good days, we're going to have bad days. There's going to be times when it really hurts, you know, and we're going to feel bad and down. But you know what? That goes away. That comes and goes, right? You have to keep going.
Right.
You just have to keep hanging on through those hard times. And that's during those hard times when it's the hardest to reach out to somebody, that's when you reach out and make a phone call.
Right.
And don't feel like a burden. Yeah.
Well,
and stick
I
with
love
it.
You to death. Lori, you're always going to be a part of my life,
Bill.
I hope, forever and ever. I expect that to be the case.
You're very precious to me.
We have to sign off tonight, but I got to tell you, you have just heard from one of my favorite people and one of the longest NASCA family members. In fact, Lori and I met each other before I really launched NASCA. So we know each other quite a while. All through her healing journey, I have watched her progress. You've progressed a lot. And you're now lovable
to
yourself.
Thank you. I think
so, how about that?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
This is Bill Murray signing off, but I want you to remember that we have these shows 5 nights a week. And Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, people tell their stories like Lori did this evening. We hope you'll join us anytime you can. at 8 o'clock Eastern, so 5 o'clock Pacific, for another edition of Stop Child Abuse Now. And so, signing off, as I always do, may God bless you and the children of the world, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse. Good night, everybody.
That dawn was you are forgotten after all that you've done.
Talk Radio.